This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Well, you can imagine my total pleasure in being in front of you again for the longest concerted single amount of time on a text in our whole term, four whole classes on, of course, what is by a factor of, I don't know, three or four or more, the biggest text of the term, namely Virgil's Aeneid. Now, just before we launch ourselves there, let me cry out the following protest. It's very, very rare that I find myself in disagreement with my long-term comrade, Professor Evans, but on the following point, I am inflexibly opposed, and as though he knew this was coming, he isn't even here this morning. Now, I happen to know he can't be here this morning, so don't even think of telling him that I was upbraiding him for not being here. I'm sure there are friends of yours who aren't here this morning whom I would upbraid, but not Professor Evans. You will recall, as part of that magnificent class on Tuesday, that Professor Evans was making a contrast between what he was moving toward, namely the incomprehensible universe of Hamlet, as he reads the play, and I'm totally persuaded, and what he then put out, starting from Aristotle's Poetics, as the coherent, comprehensible universe of the Greek tragedians. And that's what I want to protest. So if you took notes on that, or if you have it in your mind, make some big, big footnote that McCall is screaming out against it. And if my reading of Oedipus, which of course is our only, in this class, our only exemplar of Greek tragedy, has any validity at all, and of course I think it has mammoth validity, then in Sophocles' Oedipus, if Oedipus is essentially an innocent figure who goes to the limits of human endeavor to try to save a city and to try to find out who he is, and then gets smashed the way he does, through no fault of his own, because it's all been put out by fate for generations already, then in my view, Sophocles is giving us at least as incomprehensible a universe as Professor Evans wants to persuade us that Shakespeare gives us in Hamlet. And if we had time to read in some other sort of course, half a dozen, a dozen, 20, 25 tragedies, there are 33 altogether preserved from antiquity, from Greek antiquity, then in my opinion we would find time and time and time again, not always, but time and again, in Aeschylus and in Sophocles and in Euripides, that same sort of confused, senseless universe that Professor Evans so eloquently was putting before us in Shakespeare's Hamlet. So that is initial footnote or postscript to us on Sophocles and Professor Evans encroaching on my ground in an otherwise impeccable class on Hamlet. Arma virumque cano, Troiae qui primus ab oris Italiam fato profugus laviniaque venit. Now I know that there is a frisson of excitement rippling through the room. My God, you're saying to yourselves, or whatever divinity you turn to at moments like this, these classes are going to be conducted entirely in Latin. Not so. All that I have done, but a mighty thing I have done, is quote what is on the second page. Which page is it on? The second page, or, well, actually, pick up this incredible handout that you've received. It's the last document in the immortal McCall font that you'll receive. But, of course, realize that the first page of your handout is not on the overheads. That what I have here, which is the second page of your handout, is all that I have on overhead. And that's for a reason. I just want you to have this map sort of right by your side so that again and again over these next four times together we can refer to it. So that's sort of page one of the handout. And then in just a moment, we're going to do page two, who were the Romans, and then what I just declaimed to you is right there at the top of page three and will be there in a bit. So we are starting in on what, without any question whatsoever, no question whatsoever, is the most famous text, the most famous work of literature from the entirety of Roman civilization. And I would say, and can hardly imagine any person countering this, the single most influential work in the entire history of Western literature. The European Middle Ages are inconceivable without Virgil's Aeneid. The European Renaissance is inconceivable without Virgil's Aeneid. All of Western literature up to about the end of the 18th century or somewhere in the 19th century is inconceivable without Virgil's Aeneid. And then perhaps beginning with the Romantic movement and then the various literary and cultural movements of the 19th and 20th centuries, and now the 21st century, no question, as with so many other parts of the canon, Virgil's Aeneid just no longer has the kind of core motivating position for everything else that takes place in cultural and literary forms in the Western world. And yet its influence remains absolutely paramount. So we're starting an immensely big task. And I hope and expect that all of you will take this with the seriousness that I'm demanding that you do. For the purpose of our four classes together, you will be well ahead of the game, which means well ahead of me, if beginning today, you have arrived today having read ever so carefully, 18 times, the first three books of the Aeneid. And if you were to just to go in three book portions right through to class number four in a couple of weeks, you'd be well ahead of me. You have to take your cues for actual reading, of course, from your seminars. But that you must have done by the time that we meet today and on the subsequent three times. All right, now, before we just learn a little bit about who the Romans were, as we did with the Greeks, let me just give out to you and demand back from you opinions on two more of these unbelievable McCall questions. And you will see here again, ever so easily, that these questions, and who knows, for the Aeneid, mighty as it is, these may not be the last questions, but these are two questions for today. Same ground rules. Everybody has to vote. Everybody has to vote. Aaron is right here. Liz is right there. They will be the official or unofficial vote counters. We'll pretend we're counting up Senate votes in the state of Virginia. And here is question number one. Easy, straightforward. Do you believe in the existence at certain points in history of manifest destiny? Now, what I mean by the phrase manifest destiny, for any who may be a little unsure of that, is the following. A perception by a nation that it has a specific collective mission, that it has been called upon in some way to take on a specific national goal. And of course, as almost all of you surely know, the phrase comes out of late 19th century American movement toward the West Coast. Now, I'm not asking you to vote on whether the people at these various points in history believed that they were being called in some sense by manifest destiny. For sure, this was a large belief in the second half of the 19th century in the United States. I'm not asking you to vote on that. I'm rather asking you to vote whether you yourselves believe that such a force in the universe is ever at work. Do you believe this exists as an element in the flow of human history? Would anyone like to ask for any kind of clarification, or is that all as crystal clear as, except for one of my friends there, I'm sure it is? Please.
This doesn't involve divinity, does it?
It doesn't necessarily involve divinity at all. No, of course. You can say, yes, I believe that some divine force calls on a nation. You certainly can, but that is not necessary for you to believe that this force exists at some points in human history. Thank you. That's very good. That's very good. All right. All right. We're all set. It'll be a yes and a no. So all those who believe that this force of manifest destiny does exist now and again, whenever in the course of human history, so indicate. All right, all right. I saw one good person switch from the right hand to the left hand. I don't know whether that means more belief or less belief, or your right arm is hurting, or no. Now the right arm goes up again. What's going on here? All right. Do my counters have? All right. Everybody else, put up your hand. Well, this may be the closest one yet. What would you say? 60-40, 55-45? 55-45 in favor. In favor. All right. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Even if you have already made a bad judgment of how to spend your time and have only read the first book of the Aeneid, with the thoroughness that I demand for all the books, you know already that this is an immense force in the Aeneid. Just think of where I hope we'll be before the end of this morning in the first imperial prophecy of several vast imperial prophecies in the epic, in book one, when Jupiter lays out for the anxious Venus one spectacular picture of the future of Rome. All right, thank you very much. Now, number two. Do you believe that it's possible for a nation slash state to achieve and maintain superpower status while also maintaining moral, ethical virtue slash goodness? In other words, do you believe that there can be a morally uncorrupt superpower? Clarification?
Are we referring to the government itself or the individuals that make up the nation?
I think the thrust of this question has to be, as it were, the official running of that superpower. Not question whether there can be morally uncorrupt individuals in a superpower, whether that country, that state, as a collective entity. Any other question on that? All right. So again, yes and no. So all those who believe that there can be such a thing, a morally uncorrupt, are you already voting or is this a question? You're voting. Two hands. All right. Just be sure. Thumbs up is fine, but I don't want to see two hands, right? Two thumbs is fine, but you have one hand. All right. So those who say, along with my friend in the back, who is like a phone-in contest, he wants to get the prize, right? That there can be morally uncorrupt superpower, so indicate. All right. And everyone else, there cannot be such an entity. All right. This is sort of the reverse of a just universe. How can most of you vote for a just universe and vote against the possibility of a morally uncorrupt superpower? Isn't that fantastic? Anyway, what is it? It's about 75-25, something like that? All right, we'll call it 75-25. Thank you, my friends. Thank you. Yes, sir. You want to have another vote? You want to have a recount?
I don't know. That was in the 1% margin. But now, I hate to ask after the fact, but my understanding was you were asking if the superpower status conveys any additional corruption over what normally might be expected.
Yes. Oh, that was certainly implicit in the formation of the question. Does superpower status increase and perhaps make inevitable an additional level of corruption? No, that's quite right. Now, if I could say, I could have said, let's take Norway. Anybody here from Norwegian extraction? You know, Norway, is about as pure as it comes. So maybe Norway could be uncorrupt and still very vital and so on, but maybe some country whose name I can't even think of perhaps wouldn't be able to do that because it is a superpower. Yeah. All right, my friends, that's fantastic. So we're heading in to the center of the greatest superpower of the ancient world, in fact, the greatest superpower of the entire Western world until, I suppose, the British Empire. And in many ways, a more comprehensive superpower than the British Empire ever was. And that, of course, is Rome. So who were these remarkable people? Extremely briefly, here is what I want to be sure that you're aware of. The Romans and the Greeks are, as it were, first cousins. Both Indo-European speaking peoples. Proto-Italic speakers coming down from someplace in the north into the Italian peninsula about the same time as Proto-Greek speakers come down from the north into the Greek peninsula. And I'll just illustrate with a couple of words how close these languages are to one another, and therefore how ethnically close the Italic peoples and the Greek-speaking peoples were. The word for father in Greek is pater. The word for father in Latin, someone called that out, I know a number of you know that, pater, that's right. You can go through quite a long list of words in Latin and Greek that are either more or less exactly the same or clearly linguistically cousins or closer. And even if we think of the chief gods and their names on each side, the head god for the Greeks is who? Zeus. And the head god for the Romans is who?
Jupiter.
Now, what constitutes the latter part of Jupiter's name?
Jupiter.
Father. Thank you. Pater. It's just a form of pater. And you may not immediately recognize this. You have to take it on faith. But, of course, since you believe every word I speak to you, that's not tough. The U in Latin, Jupiter, is linguistically absolutely related to not just to Zeus, but in the genitive, Zeus becomes Dios. Dios and Jupiter are almost the same. So the head gods, the gods of the sky, the gods, the head of the pantheon of Greek gods and Roman gods, linguistically almost identical. Now, so here are all these proto-Italic peoples sort of making their way down through the Italic peninsula. Mythically, around about 1200 BC, Aeneas and his fellow Trojans reach Italy. That's mythically because that timeline has to fit in with the mythical timeline of the Trojan War as established in Greek storytelling, in Greek epic. Historically, archaeologists have shown that Carthage, which of course is an integral part of the movement, the mythical legendary story of the movement of Aeneas and his fellow Trojans eventually to Italy. The stop in Carthage is, of course, totally crucial. Historically, we know that Carthage was actually only started by Phoenician, i.e. Semitic, settlers from the coast of Lebanon, round Tyre and so, round about 800 BC. So no surprise to anyone, unless people insist on trying to have myth and history be the same thing, which I trust no one in this room would want to do. So mythically, there's one, as it were, chronology. Historically, the Phoenicians established the city of Carthage round about 800 BC. Mythically, Rome itself is founded. The Romans even put a specific date on, a specific year, 753, counting back from later on when they had everything firmly organized. That cannot be, in my view, and in almost every scholar's view, a historical year. Can't be all that far off, for when people speaking an early form of Latin established themselves as a tiny, tiny, tiny little village at a particular bend in the Tiber River, a series of bends in the Tiber River, about 15 miles or so from the sea. Can't be far off, but that is a mythical construct. This is the Romans inventing later on their own earliest history. But historically, and that's true for everything else in this very, very short selective list, historically, we know that after an early period of about 200 years where the existing, flowering, magnificent Etruscan civilization dominated what was this little village of very, very early Rome. In fact, Etruscan kings ruled in Rome for about a century and a half, but they were tossed out at the end of the 6th century BC, and thereafter, for the next 500 years, the single theme of little tiny village like Rome is expansion. Inch by inch, yard by yard, mile by mile, and eventually country by country. And fairly early on in their national consciousness, certainly by the time that we get down to the Second Punic War, the Hannibalic War, certainly by then, in some ways even earlier, the Romans, without any question, thought of themselves as chosen to rule. I don't believe that there exists in Latin the exact equivalent of manifest destiny, but the Romans talked about that concept in all sorts of different ways, and they believed it about themselves. Now, by the time that the Second Punic War came about, and I'll explain the term and so forth just momentarily, Rome, this little village, had in effect become the master, the mistress of most of the peninsula of Italy, from about the Po up there, sort of at the region of Venice, on south, almost all the way down to the whole boot of Italy. Italy essentially was under the control of Rome at the time when the great power of Carthage across just about the narrowest part of the Mediterranean. Take out that great map, not in the McCall font, but look where Carthage is. Just what modern country is Carthage in?
Tunisia,
thank you. So ancient Carthage is now sort of on the outskirts of incredible excavations of ancient Carthage, now on the outskirts of modern Tunis. So just, it's 100 miles or less from Sicily, and right there in the middle of the Mediterranean, where all the trade routes go through, whoever controls that passageway or those passageways through the central Mediterranean controls most of the economy of the ancient Mediterranean. And that, for sure, was the essential reason why the growing power of Rome and the long existing mercantile economic power of Carthage came into conflict. They actually came into conflict earlier on than the Second Punic War. As you might guess, there was a First Punic War about the middle of the 3rd century BC, and it was essentially fought over Sicily. Why not? Look at the map. Of course it's going to be fought over Sicily. Rome had gotten down about into the toe of Italy. There was Carthage right on the other side of Sicily with a lot of colonies and commercial ports existing already in Sicily. And the First Punic War was fought for about 25 years over Sicily. Rome won. And in fact, at that point, Sicily became the first Roman province. And eventually, Rome ruled the entire Mediterranean and so much else through provinces. Then this great, electrifying, charismatic military leader, Hannibal, arose and almost brought Rome to her knees. Spain is not on this particular map, but just fill in Spain there on the left side. Carthage controlled a lot of the eastern seaboard and the southern seaboard of Spain. Rome was moving out that way. In 218 BC, at the beginning of the Second Punic War, Hannibal and his Carthaginian army were posted over there in Spain. And various things led to the outbreak of the war, and then Hannibal engaged in his famous march over the Pyrenees, along the Riviera, surely pausing for some sights along the way, and then across the Alps with his elephants. He had about 40 or 50 elephants. How they got through the snows of the Alps and over into the nice lush plains of northern Italy, no one will ever quite be able to figure out. But we know it happened, because we know they fought against and terrified the Roman armies in the first series of battles once Hannibal's army got into northern Italy. Hannibal's army got there, just swept down the length of Italy, massacring one Roman army after another. 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 Roman soldiers exterminated in a single day at a series of about four incredible battle sites. And eventually, the last of these was actually south of Rome. So Hannibal swept down, passed Rome by, made his last amazing defeat of a complete Roman army, and then did not turn back and attack Rome then and there. And it's one of the great lingering questions of all history. Why did Hannibal not go after Rome at that moment? Probably because, being not just a charismatic, electrifying military commander, but a very thoughtful and organized one, he figured, I'll stay in southern Italy, cement my supply lines back across Sicily, back to Carthage, and then I have Rome exactly where I want her. I can turn any time I want against Rome and take Rome. But, of course, he couldn't, and he didn't. And these amazing Romans, having suffered one disaster after another, somehow always during this long Second Punic War. Punic, because the Latin word for Carthaginian is Punicus. Punicus. So it's the first war against the Punici, and the second war, and eventually a third war. The Romans kept coming back, building up their armies once again, and 15 years after this, eventually, they defeated Hannibal at the end of the Second Punic War, back near Carthage, the conclusive battle, not in Italy anymore, but back on Carthaginian territory. Now, I've said all of this about Hannibal in the Second Punic War because, my friends, all of us now experiencing the Aeneid, think of us being of that generation that first got the Aeneid, round about 20 BC, and in the years and decades immediately thereafter, we had been brought up knowing, every one of us, male and female alike, that the greatest enemy that we, the master of the world at Rome, the greatest enemy we had ever had to confront, and the enemy who all but exterminated us, was Hannibal and the Carthaginians. And in fact, mothers and grandmothers would frighten their children or punish them or send them to bed with nightmares by telling them stories about Hannibal. If you don't go to sleep, Hannibal will come and will lop off your fingers one by one. So don't make any more noise. This is a very good tactic, I can promise you. So do not even think of forgetting the symbolic, the overwhelming symbolic power of the vision historically for us in the age of Virgil, at the very height of the beginning of the Roman Empire, having in our minds this horror of us at an earlier age coming that close to being decimated by the Carthaginians and by Hannibal. So after this, the Romans continued to, one by one, to take over the entire ancient Mediterranean and beyond. In the first century BC, beginning in the latter part of the second century BC, the Roman Republic that had come into existence when the Etruscan kings were kicked out began to creak ever more woefully under, we'll just say, the weight of running the world. And powerful, ambitious generals kept sort of pushing at the limits of obeying the rules of what you should do with an army when you get at the end of a campaign back close to Rome. You're supposed to make your army disband and go home to their farms. But great generals like Pompey and others began, and Julius Caesar eventually, began not to do that. And when Julius Caesar, in that famous phrase, crosses the Rubicon, which is a little river up in the northern part of Italy, he crosses it with his army, and that's exactly the point where people like the noble Brutus and Cassius say, this man is aiming at dictatorship. He has crossed the Rubicon with his army. And eventually this all comes true in a horrible way, and the Republic just sort of splinters apart, and out of the ruins of the Republic, an incredible, focused, viciously ambitious, pitiless, and ever so smart young man arises, Octavian. He's a great nephew of Julius Caesar. Eventually he takes on, he allows himself to be called in a very almost divine way Augustus, and he becomes the first emperor of the newly established Roman Empire, which now has succeeded, has replaced the tottering and now disappeared Roman Republic. And the key battle there, which we'll come back to in several different places in the Aeneid, is the Battle of Actium in 31 BC. Where Octavian, in the sea battle off the coast of western Greece, defeats Antony and Cleopatra. All right. Now, just as I change the overhead, is there anything anyone would like to raise or ask about that? You will see, I hope and pray, that everything that I've done here is absolutely applicable to themes and issues that come up in our text. All right. Now, we'll just
finish off today by the rest of the sort of general thematic and structural lead-ins to the examination book by book of the epic that we'll undertake beginning next Tuesday. All right. Now, skip for a moment down past the first two lines. Actually, don't skip quite yet. I mean, I've done the first two lines, but it is just impossible not to allow, indeed compel, everybody in this class to be able to go through the rest of your lives quoting the first three words of the Aeneid, every educated person in the world. And you're the only educated people at Stanford because you're in this class, should be able to do that. So, arma virumque cano. Now, I want to hear it. I don't want to see any silent lips here, no lip syncing. I really want to hear it. Let's raise the roof here. Ready? Arma virumque cano. That's about a D minus minus. You ready? Come on now, come on. Arma virumque cano. Use this to your social advantage. All right. Publius Vergilius Maro. There are his dates. He was born up in the north, up near Lake Como in that area. He came to Rome round about 50 BC. Or so, ambitious, young, aesthetic fellow, started to write his poetry in the 40s, almost instantly gained, crucially for him, gained billionaire patronage in the form of the richest man in Rome, Maecenas. And of course, we have a saying, the wealth of Maecenas is like the wealth of Croesus on the Greek side. So Maecenas, who was a great patron of the arts, took this young provincial poet, Virgil, into his stable, so to speak, and then eventually, about 10 years later in the 30s BC, the rising Octavian, now almost in control of the entire Roman world, also took Virgil under his wing as it were, a second patron. Virgil published distributed two sets of poems before he embarked on the Aeneid. One is a group of 10 pastoral poems called the Eclogues, distributed around 40 BC. And the other, 10 years later, is four books of farming poems, but with heavy political parts to them. Sort of middle America crying out about its political importance, vaguely. For our purposes, it is crucially important to know that in that first group of distributed poems, the Eclogues, one of these 10 poems, the fourth Eclogue, has an amazing passage in the midst of talking about shepherds, as pastoral poetry tends to do, shepherds who are troubled by the issues of the day. This poem has a ringing and glorious prediction of the coming of a new golden age. And this new golden age is going to be marked by a birth of a boy. Birth of a boy, new golden age. Now, this group of poems was set out to us, the reading public, round about 40 B.C., the early Christian church took it as absolute divine revelation that this prophecy in Virgil's fourth Eclogue is a prophecy of the coming of Jesus Christ. And this was one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons why the early Christian church, while feeling very dismissive about a lot of pagan literature, treated Virgil
as though Virgil were, in effect, a saint. Every word of Virgil was preserved. And in fact, we have everything that Virgil ever preserved, ever composed. Now, just after Octavian gained control through the Battle of Actium, in a final way of the entire Roman world, he, in effect, in an informal way, not through a publishing contract, but somehow just the understanding was clear that he authorized, in fact, he required Virgil now to move on to what would be his greatest poem, a national epic. This was Virgil's mission, as signed on to by Augustus himself. And Virgil spent the rest of his all-too-short life very slowly, very carefully. It's been worked out to be an average of about 3 verses a day over about a decade to compose, to write the Aeneid. One more minute worth of stuff. When Virgil died unexpectedly in 19 BC, the Aeneid was not finished. It is an unfinished national epic poem. And in fact, Virgil left word, totally firm word, sort of in his will, that his poem, the Aeneid, was to be destroyed because it was not finished. Thanks be to Jupiter, his literary executors, literally, he had 2 literary executors who consulted with Augustus and decided to defy, to disobey Virgil's own express wishes. And very shortly after Virgil died, the Aeneid became disseminated throughout the Roman world. Now I'm going to stop there, but we're not quite through with that second page. We're going to start up next time with Homer, Roman imperial destiny, and Stoicism. All right, thank you.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.